Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 61. It's July 23rd, 2020. I just got another 321 Thursday email from James Clear. Here goes. Three ideas from him. One, progress requires unlearning. Two, live with a bias toward action. Ironically, this will teach you patience. When you take action each day, you learn the value of accumulating small improvements over time. You understand how daily habits compound. Be impatient with your actions. Be patient with your results. Three, if a decision is reversible, the biggest risk is moving too slow. If a decision is irreversible, the biggest risk is moving too fast. Two quotes from others. One, writer and entrepreneur Kevin Kelly on the value of friends. Friends are better than money. Almost anything money can do, friends can do better. In so many ways, a friend with a boat is better than owning a boat. Two, scientist Marie Curie on the importance of self-improvement. You cannot hope to build a better world without improving the individuals. To that end, each of us must work for his own improvement and at the same time share a general responsibility for all humanity. Our particular duty being to aid those to whom we think we can be most useful. And one question for us. Imagine each day is only 12 hours long. What would you cut out? That's it. I can't promise I won't read another one of these in its entirety again. I like them. Certainly of late, thinking through, talking about action and education and freedom and such things. James Clear swims in the same river, for sure. And there's some really neat little ideas here. And Kevin Kelly, seeing Kevin Kelly's name, I mean, I've got to get to a lot of his thinking. 1,000 True Fans in particular is interesting. And getting into business models for creators today and all that kind of stuff is fun and fruitful amplifier territory. And just fascinating stuff. And the idea, too, of each of us focusing on ourselves and then try to help somebody is very Wendell Berry Think Little. So it's all as always, kind of here of a piece. I am tempted, though, to begin soon to also address economics, macroeconomics, economic policy, economic development. Huge news here locally yesterday, confirmed in a shareholder conference call, I believe, that Tesla has selected Del Valle, just outside Austin. And they're coming here. Gigafactory, 5,000 jobs, $1 billion capital investment, a major undertaking. And yesterday afternoon and evening, a lot of texts were flying around among various group threads that I've got ongoing with different pools of people. And some are already bummed out by how much Austin has grown and changed in the last 30 years. And they see that as just yet further acceleration of that. Expenses going up, property taxes going up, character changing and rule changing and disruption in that sense. Some find Elon Musk problematic, some maybe politically, maybe. Some, even if they might sort of be more disposed to agree with some of that, they get bummed out by the public dollars, the subsidies that have flown through his various enterprises, which I'm sure are extensive. And not just for this land deal or whatever, it's Texas taxes, but subsidies for Tesla and solar and long, long list, I'm sure. Others extremely excited that Tesla is coming here, that this is yet another massive boost to Austin and the brain power of Austin and the talent base in Austin, and that it's just also correctly in the mix, pointing out what an incredible enterprise it really is and the data that it has in terms of autonomous vehicles, the manufacturing understanding that it has, its presence in solar, its presence in batteries, its presence in energy. So it's a fascinating little moment. So we'll see how that all plays out. But there was a lot of interesting commentary and debate just in texts and links and jokes and good stuff. I hope they do tours. I've gone down and toured the Toyota plant between here and San Antonio. And it is just fascinating. It's awesome. It's just an awesome sight to behold. And it's interesting, too, speaking of economic policy and economic development, what's going on in the world today. You know, that was built sometime in the mid-80s. Basically, most, if not all, of the Japanese auto plants came here in the mid-late 80s. There's a very particular reason for that. And it doesn't get a lot of play necessarily. I had a professor in business school, one of the most brilliant people I've ever been around. And he told us about it offhandedly in a lecture. The thing about Tasu Shirvani, he only even taught us half a class. I'd had core marketing with Dr. Philip Zerillo, Dr. Z. Shout out to Dr. Z, wherever you are. Last I knew, he's living in Singapore now. Dr. Z had worked his way through Kellogg, partially doing stand-up comedy. He's a great lecturer, incredibly friendly, gregarious guy, and had him for a core class, took his elective class. Without even thinking about what the course was about, not caring, just wanted to take another class from him. And he was co-teaching with Tasu. So Dr. Z, incredibly friendly and bright and permanent smile kind of individual, is telling us about the class, first day of class. And Tasu shows up just to be introduced. He's not going to show up till we're halfway through. And I think Dr. Z was teaching channels, distribution, and Tasu had pricing. So Tasu said hi. And then when he came back, actually, that day, he had heard Dr. Zerillo explaining, like, you know, class participation is important, a lot of cases, need you here, part of the grade, and that kind of thing. Typical first day of class sort of stuff. Tasu, who we just met, you know, I'd never seen the man before, he says, hey, I don't really care if you're here or not. I don't care. There's going to be, like, two papers. No big deal. I figure you're all adults. Either show up or don't. I think this was a Tuesday evening class, so 3 hours every Tuesday. And he said, you know what, I'm gonna show up here. I'm going to start at 6. I might go till 11 some Tuesdays. Leave whenever you want. I have office hours twice a week. Here they are. You can come by anytime you want. Yours. This semester, as long as you want, as long as you need. My day rate's, you know, $10,000, $20,000 a day. So I would take advantage of it while you're here. And his class was incredible. It was truly incredible. So we had him maybe 10 weeks. I can't remember exactly. And on the first day of his portion of the course, he puts up a very simple slide. It's a circle, and it's got like four factors inside the circle, four factors outside the circle. This is what he's going to talk about with respect to pricing. But really, it's everything about a firm. And so factors inside are things like, you know, your cost, and factors outside are like your competition, but also like industry structure and regulation and customer preference, technology, things like that. And as an example, I loved my strategy course. I had a great strategy professor, got a lot of value out of it. But truly, like, Tasu's single lecture on industry structure was almost as valuable as that entire course. It's just a fire hose of highly distilled, incredibly dense knowledge. Great stuff. And then I had the benefit, as yet another tangential, by the way, of working with those two gentlemen for several years after business school, before friends who had started Despair.com, we got to riffing and later started Amplifier as a thing. So, but going back to Tasu and going back to, he was showing us industry structure and saying that basically, many industries, you're going to end up with three dominant players. And sometimes number one is twice as large or larger than number two, who's twice as large or larger than number three, and the other participants divide up the rest. And by that, it really meant full-line generalists, that you're in all product markets and all geographic markets. And he was pointing out how there used to be a thing called the United States automobile industry, for example, and a thing called the Asian automobile industry, and a thing called the European automobile industry. But with globalization, with the way they were, you know, able to move goods on those gigantic container ships, that there was no longer anything called an American automobile industry. There was just the global automobile industry. So there was going to be a reshuffling. And he started with rows and columns and showing, like, look, this is what's going to happen. You can see how the consolidation is going to play out, because you must get geographic and product line coverage if you want to remain standing. You can be a product specialist or a geographic specialist in a very profitable businesses, but there's a new race on. And then he did the same thing showing, like, how technology or regulation was were playing a role in changing other industries. That there used to be something called the cable industry and something called the satellite industry and local and long distance telephone, and all that's just getting smashed in together. And this is where we're headed. And in that context, he was showing how, you know, the Japanese automakers had come here and pointed out that for decades, you've got, you know, post-World War II, Marshall Plan, all this kind of stuff, where we're going to help rebuild what had been destroyed in the fighting of World War II. And the Japanese had really focused on different kinds of, you know, electronics and manufacturing and automobiles, and were moving into computers, semiconductors, things like that. There was a lot of exchange rate gamesmanship going on, and by the and things too, like in the United States, at least in this telling, capital is distributed largely through Wall Street. In Japan and Germany, the banks have a much greater role in that kind of allocation, and the government would do these long-term low-interest loans, and that gave a different risk profile for capital spend. And so, as a general rule, this is just one of Tassi's just saying something is just sort of a little heuristic, is that you're not really allowed to compete inside Japan. Very hard to get in Japan. If you can get in, you can run the table, because it's incredibly inefficient domestically. But if they get into your market, they're very, very tough to compete with. Very tough to compete with. So imagine there's a thing called the Plaza Accords, is where I'm going with this. I don't know how I got to Plaza Accords from James Clear's Thursday email, but here we are. And the Plaza, they're called the Plaza Accords because they're negotiated at the Plaza Hotel in New York City. And I don't remember the G something, G8, G7, whatever the number was at the time. The sort of central bankers, economic ministers gather. And the U.S.'s contention is that the German and Japanese exchange rates are artificially low. They're artificially manipulating their currency so that their products are cheaper in the U.S. And at the time, the Japanese automakers were making all their cars in Japan. That means they are spending yen on their plant and equipment and people. They load up these ships. They bring them across the ocean to Seattle or Los Angeles and roll them off into the United States market, where they sell them and get dollars. They take those dollars back home. And what the U.S. wanted to do was to say, this is wildly simplifying. I'll see if I can find some great historical references to this. But the U.S. was saying is, you need to, your currency needs to rise in value against the dollar. And the Japanese were more or less like, no, thank you. That's okay. And we're not manipulating, and we don't want to do that. And again, the Japanese market was largely closed. The United States market was largely wide open. Oh, you have an entire container ship full of Honda Accords? Great. Bring them in. No problem. But the reverse did not apply. And so the U.S. had less to lose in any of this kind of tussling. And so, and there's all kinds of things you can start to do. Well, what if these container ships fail inspection? Or what if you slow it all down? What if you grind it to a halt? What if you turn them around and send it back home? Or you know, tariffs. Tariffs are floating around right now. This president loves to throw this around as a negotiating mechanism. I'm not sure how many actual tariffs have been put into play, but I will say this. It's fascinating to watch. And I would say, you've heard me rail against the media. Whenever these things come up with France, Germany, Japan, China, show me a site somewhere that isn't simply regurgitating newspaper columns and TV segments onto its website. Give me someone who's providing real context and understanding. For example, after all the time you may have spent thinking about this, looking about this, hearing about this, tell me anything you can about the tariffs between the United States and France, or the United States and Canada, or the United States and Japan, or the United States and China. Tell me about whose markets are open, whose markets are closed, and how the tariffs behave. I'm willing to bet there's not parity. Even someone like Peter Zeihan, his whole thesis of looking at geography, history, and geopolitics is the United States, since the 40s, has been wide open. Well, here in the 80s, the Reagan administration, Jim Baker, guys like this start to say, you know what? What if we weren't so open, Japan? And Japan had a lot to lose. The American wallet is incredibly important, vitally important if you're a Japanese automaker. And here's the United States saying, you know what we want you to do? We want the value of your currency to rise. We want the value of the dollar to fall by half against the yen. Now think of what that means if you're making automobiles and all of your costs are in yen. Now the dollars you're going to get back take a 50% haircut, half. That's not good for business. So how do you contend with this move? Well, you have to get your costs in dollars. Your costs can't be in yen anymore. How do you get your costs in dollars? You make the cars here. That's why, if you go look at the history of all of these Japanese auto plants coming to the U.S., they opened in the 80s in response to this policy move. Interesting stuff, right? And they and also interesting in a whole different set of complex topics. They come to the South. They're not interested in going to, where's the talent? Where's everybody that knows how to do this? They're in the upper Midwest. But you got unions, you've got institutional sort of expectation. Whereas in the South, it's like, wait, you're going to put an auto plant here? We'll roll out the red carpet. So it's interesting, too, to watch today Tesla playing a similar game. They have nothing. Exchange rates aren't important, but you know they're getting upset with California, and they go looking, and they audition Tulsa and Austin at least that we know about, and as of yesterday, theoretically, they're coming here. Also, though, I think it merits discussing like very basic building blocks, like the whole point of all of this. We're talking about skills and learning and entrepreneurship and these sorts of things. We all want to go build value. We have ideas and we want to express them. We want to turn them into companies and or go participate in the economy in whatever way. And if you don't spend everything that you make, what you end up with is called savings, and you need a place to put it. You're delaying consumption for some future date. That's called savings. We have lots of options. Tremendous amounts of options, financial options and non-financial options, really. And so where do we put it? And to talk about all of that sort of stuff, we really do have to talk about banking. And if we're going to touch on any of that, it sure merits talking about the financial crisis of 2008 and the basic structure of the system. In Dispatches Past, we touched on Hernando de Soto and the mysteries of capital and Julian Simon and the real nature of wealth. And so all of that has to come into play. I'm eager to start working those sources into the mix, and we'll see how it plays out. I'll leave it at that. A lot more to say, but go subscribe to James Clear. I will put a link to it at regular.fm/61. Hopefully we'll get back to Gary Shandling and more, much more about him and other comedians actually sometime soon. For what it's worth, this morning I did get up at the alarm today at 4:50. Had a great morning and got a lot of other things done and just had a nice stretch too of a good period of quiet. And I'm recording this a little later in the day in a pocket between meetings. But I'm glad I did because James Clear dropped another bit of gold our way. Talk to you soon.